I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Gentlemen, my name is John Moser. I am in for Jeff Sickinga for another edition of The American Idea. And today we're talking to an extremely prolific author of popular histories. He has many, many very terrific works here. Iron Horse, America's Race to Bring the Railroads West. Rival Rails, The Race to Build America's Greatest Transcontinental Railroad. The French and Indian War, Deciding the Fate of North America, 1812, The War That Forged a Nation, Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land, most recently, MacArthur at War, World War II in the Pacific. But we have him here today with us to talk about a book that he had published in 2012, The Admirals, Nimitz, Halsey, Leahy and King, the five-star admirals who won the war at sea. Walt Borneman, thank you for joining us today.
John, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So why is it that everyone who really knows anything about World War II knows the names Douglas MacArthur, George Patton, Dwight Eisenhower, whereas you really have to be sort of invested in the study of the war to know the names of men like Nimitz and King and Leahy? Why aren't these men talked about as much?
I think that's an interesting question. It has a little bit to do with the Pacific theater. I mean, the European theater, I think, really overshadows the war. Interestingly enough, one of the four admirals that I've written about, Ernest J. King, who's chief of naval operations and commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet, he's the one very early in the war that really talks about a global strategy. He's the one who says to the Joint Chiefs, let's indeed, sure, Germany first in terms of defeat, but let's indeed put a fair amount of resources into the Pacific. So Ernest J. King is almost completely overlooked. Halsey, I think, gets some credit because of his exploits, particularly at the Battle of Leyte. And many people forget that Chester Nimitz was doing almost as much, maybe more, depending on what battles and what was happening, as MacArthur did. And of course, just to pick up on the fourth one of that quartet of admirals, like to talk to you about in depth as we go through this, is William D. Leahy, who's basically in the White House wearing multiple hats for Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, that's very interesting. But what we're here to talk about today is the last few months of the war in the Pacific Theater of Operations. Could you help set the stage for us? The fighting is winding down in the Philippines. Please tell us more about the general situation in the Pacific in early 1945.
We have to go back into 1944, a couple of months to the fall of 44 to really answer that question. You know, historically, through the 3 years of the war, there have always been these twin drives across the Pacific. The one across the Central Pacific that Nimitz was leading, essentially from Hawaii west through the Marianas, Guam, and Saipan by the fall of 1944. And there's this other front, this thrust that MacArthur is leading from Australia, going back, his drive, of course, to get through New Guinea and return to the Philippines. So by the fall of 1944, Nimitz is basically poised in the Central Pacific to go ahead and continue to take islands en route to Japan, Iwo Jima, for sure. And by March of 1945, he's going to invade Okinawa. The spring of 1945 finds MacArthur heavily engaged in the Philippines, trying to take Manila, which he certainly finally does at great cost, both to the inhabitants and to the city proper. At the same time, Nimitz is in the Central Pacific, having by the end of February 1945 taken Iwo Jima and become involved also in a much longer campaign than he had planned against Okinawa. So there's the two drives toward Japan that are happening in the beginning, the early spring of 1945.
The United States engages in two separate offensive operations, one through the Central Pacific, one through the Southwest Pacific. One often repeated maxim of war is that you should never divide your forces in the face of the enemy. However, the United States chooses to do exactly that. Why dispense with that core directive from military history?
I think the one short answer is one word, MacArthur. I mean, there's some political aspects to that, that having left the Philippines in the early March of 1942, made this epic, I shall return. George Marshall and others tried to get him to say, we shall return, but he never did. It was always I. And every time progress was made in the Central Pacific, MacArthur continually lobbied for that effort to get back to the Philippines. Now, I think he did so, to his credit, for a couple of reasons. One, he felt a true allegiance and concern for the Filipino people. And if you look at a map of the Western Pacific, it's pretty clear where most of Japan's natural resources were coming from. Their occupied territories in the Dutch East Indies, they're bringing supplies and raw materials and everything else up to Japan from the south. And the Philippines almost sits astride that supply line. So MacArthur did have, I think, a military reason, a strategic reason for his offensive. And, you know, every time the Joint Chiefs debated this, it was kind of like, well, you know, we're making progress across the Central Pacific and you know, MacArthur's doing his thing. So it just continued. And quite frankly, that dual approach, as I've just mentioned, really continues almost all the way through the end of the war. Until, jumping ahead a second, by April of 45, Douglas MacArthur finally is in expectation of the invasion of Japan, given command of all American, all Allied, really, ground and air forces.
Manila has finally fallen to U.S. forces. Nimitz is held up for the time being on Okinawa. Now America is considering the end game, and that probably means an invasion of the Japanese home islands. What problems did American military planners face in trying to put together a design for that and in thinking about how to launch such an operation?
On the positive side, it's amazing the outpouring of ships, planes, supplies. You know, MacArthur historically has said, well, I didn't get enough material. Truth of the matter is, sometimes he had to be urged to unload some of the material he was receiving. So this great outpouring of America's industrial might that is really fueling not only the war in Europe, but the war in the Pacific, is really stockpiling and getting ready for what I think everyone recognizes is going to be a pretty horrific invasion. Got to remember that the kamikaze attacks that really start to cause havoc with the American Navy in particular really don't start in earnest until the fall of 44. And by the spring of 45, they are coming so ferociously that it's really clear that the closer you get to Japan, the more serious and the harder the Japanese military is going to defend itself. Just a quick aside, remember April, May that we're talking about here, what happens in Europe? Germany finally, after the horrendous Battle of the Bulge and kind of almost a redo in terms of Allied strategy eastward across Europe, Germany surrenders on May 7th. So the focus, both militarily and I think to some extent politically in the short term, and you've written about Yalta, glad to talk about Yalta and some of those ramifications, but in the short term, the focus shifts to the Western Pacific. And are we going to invade Japan? Are we going to try to bomb it completely? Or are we going to simply impose a naval blockade and wait? And we can talk about those particular options as we go forward here.
So as the United States is planning either for an invasion or from a longer-term blockade, maybe we should spend a moment and talk about the other side of the coin. What's going on in Tokyo at this time? Is there any indication among Japanese military and political leaders that they might want out of the war?
Well, I think internally there is a division that quite frankly didn't appear at that time as well as in retrospect, where there was a part of the Japanese military that was trying to figure a way how to get out of it. At one point, there's even a faction that suggests that the way to get out of it is somehow to have Russia get into the war earlier than it does, and then go ahead and make, even if it's a separate peace with Russia. Well, obviously, MacArthur in particular and the American side didn't like that idea at all. And I think, conversely, we've got to go back that there is this part of the Japanese military, exemplified by the kamikazes, who really are going to be determined to fight to the death. And some of the bonsai charges and things that we know from history that occur, and the fighting in the caves and the resistance on Okinawa and on Iwo Jima. I mean, the American high command is really concerned that kind of, at least some of them, are really concerned that kind of resistance is going to occur on the main four Japanese home islands.
So what it comes down to is the United States has a few options. One is invade with the understanding that casualties are going to be very high. Another is that the United States could continue with conventional bombardment, reducing Japanese cities to cinders one by one. Another is the imposition of a blockade in the hope of slowly starving the Japanese until a surrender is produced, or some combination of those three. It's only in the summer of 1945, though, that a fourth option comes into play, and that is, of course, the atomic bomb. To what extent are the admirals aware of this possibility?
That's interesting in that it depends where and who they are. And let me explain that. William D. Leahy, who is really Roosevelt's chief, he's serving since 1942 as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, effectively as what we today would call National Security Advisor and White House Chief of Staff. I mean, could you imagine today one person holding all of those positions? Leahy, as Roosevelt's close confidant and all of those positions, knows everything. He's been in the loop since the beginning. George Marshall has informed Admiral King, as head of the Navy, that the atomic bomb is being developed early in 1943. And of course, all of that sworn to secrecy. Nimitz and Halsey, who are out doing things at the operational level, don't learn about the bomb until much later. Nimitz, as commander-in-chief of the Pacific, is told about the possibility of it being tested and deployed in February of 1945. Halsey, who's it's kind of interesting, you know, Halsey and Spruance rotate back and forth. So Halsey is at that particular point been rotated off of the Pacific Command of what's called the Third Fleet, what he's in command. And it's only in June that he gets really back to sea. He's not told about it until July. Now, what about MacArthur? No one, John, is going to tell MacArthur about this because they don't want to read about it in one of his press releases. They don't trust the guy to not go on about this. So MacArthur is not told about this until only roughly 10 days, 2 weeks or so before the first bombs dropped on the Hiroshima. So, you know, there's depending on who you are, there's different versions of that. Now, you know, we can jump ahead and say, well, what did they think about it? Kind of remember that all four of these admirals kind of come of age in a battleship world. Nimitz is going to cut his teeth in submarines, and King and Halsey are going to get heavily involved in carriers. But they're all, and particularly Leahy, is a battleship admiral. So Leahy is the one who says, and by this time Roosevelt's dead, and he Leahy is in Potsdam with Truman. Leahy basically says, you know, I'm not even sure it's going to work. And if it does work, I'm not sure we ought to use it. And I think rather prophetically to the Cold War years, Leahy is on record as saying, you know, if one force has it, one way or the other, others are going to have it. And, you know, what does that mean for mankind? King, and Nimitz in particular, I think we're also sort of circumspect about its deployment. I think Nimitz is on record as saying, when he's finally told about this, sort of dejectedly, that, well, you know, maybe I was born too late. It's a different kind of warfare. And I think that there was a military tone to that, but I think all of these men, with the exception perhaps of Halsey, also understood the political ramifications going forward of deploying this weapon.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, Chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So, if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Eisenhower, after the war, expressed reservations about the atomic bomb, suggested that it might not have been necessary. This would have been quite a difference from the sentiment of ordinary soldiers who were being, you know, who were preparing for an invasion of Japan, right?
I think that's a good point, and I can only refer to my own dad, who had been with the AmeriCal division in the Philippines, and quite frankly, I guess also to so many other veterans or sons of veterans that I've spoken to, is that when the news came, because my dad was ready to leave from the Philippines to go north to Okinawa and stage for the main invasion at Kyushu, The news came that the bomb had been used and the war was over. There was only one piece of that that was important to the rank and file. The war was over. They were going home. I mean, others could debate the political ramifications, the long-term humanitarian ramifications, but to the guy with an M1 over his shoulder about to splash ashore on a heavily occupied home island of Japan, the only thing they cared about is that they were on the troop ship going the other way back home.
Of course, the decision to use the atomic bomb is made at the very top. The decision belongs to Truman and Truman alone. What factors appear to have influenced Truman in his decision to use the atomic bomb instead of pursuing other options that we mentioned?
Well, it's kind of interesting that Truman, of course, when we talk about who knew and who didn't know, Truman didn't know about this. Roosevelt dies on April 12th. And of course, Leahy has been essentially running the show. Roosevelt comes back from Yalta, just totally worn out. He goes to Warm Springs to rest up. Kind of interesting that Leahy doesn't take that trip with him. For 3 years, with one short exception, Leahy's always been with him. And we could speculate why, but I think it's because Leahy must have recognized that the end was near. So the point is that Leahy is the one, I think, who informs Truman at some length about the bomb. And certainly, what I definitely would say is that Leahy is the one who translates or interprets or educates Harry Truman in all of what Roosevelt has done. And I think Truman was hoping to bring the war to a fairly rapid conclusion. And despite the arguments that, well, the blockade would work, or that, you know, we've literally, thanks to the B-29s that have begun flying from Saipan and Guam, you know, the B-29s have pretty well decimated all the Japanese cities. I still think he felt that there was an opportunity to make enough of a statement that the war would end more quickly. Now, the other interesting thing, maybe ask a question of you, you know, how much did he make that decision based on strength that he wanted to show our Soviet, at that point, allies? I don't really know the answer to that.
One argument that's been put forward by some scholars is that Truman was mainly interested in impressing the Soviets, that already there was some sense that U.S.-Soviet relations were falling apart, and in preparing for the post-war world, Truman wanted to show Stalin who was in charge. Personally, I think the evidence for that is pretty thin. The documents don't seem to bear it out. But beyond that, I think a lot of it is reading the Cold War backward into history. It doesn't look like in the middle of 1945, Truman is anticipating a Cold War. Truman at this point, yeah, sure, there are problems in the U.S.-Soviet relationship. There always had been. But there's no evidence that I've seen that suggests that Truman had this grand plan going on to put the United States on a solid footing for an upcoming Cold War. He simply didn't see that happening. On the other hand, what I do see with Truman is the uncertainty. No, uncertainty is the wrong word, I think. Let's just say the situation faced by a man who has only been president now for a few months, who didn't even know about the atomic bomb project until he had become president. And now he is thrust from a position of relative obscurity, I mean, as obscure as a U.S. senator from Missouri can be, to being arguably the most important man in the world. And he is faced with a weapon that's of unprecedented power. He's also faced with a civilian population and a military population that is increasingly sick of the war. If you are Truman in that situation, I don't see how you do anything other than to choose the atomic bomb.
I think I would agree with that. And you're right that as much as Roosevelt, I've made the point, and we can talk about Yalta if you want. I've made the point in the Admirals that Roosevelt was enough of a multilateral internationalist that I think he would have had the same kind of level of commitment to and optimism, perhaps, in terms of post-war cooperation 2 years prior, because he really did in terms of earlier meetings with Stalin and everything, as he had at Yalta. And I guess the point being is that this idea that Roosevelt gave so much away because he was a sick old man by that point. You know, a lot of what still happened at Yalta was in keeping with his earlier views. And quite frankly, Roosevelt is on record as saying to William D. Leahy, attend all of these meetings for me, keep notes on everything, and really entrusted Leahy with far more than his military portfolio. But increasingly, as we go through 1945, and I think this informs both Truman's education in the presidency and his decision, whether it be the bomb or other things or where he might be on Poland, Leahy increasingly takes on a wide role politically as well as militarily.
So it's probably worth mentioning that Truman would end up getting a pretty skewed view of what happened at Yalta. The reason for that was, well, of course, he hadn't been president when Yalta took place. Most of the information that he got about what happened at Yalta would have come from James Burns, who would, in fact, be Truman's first Secretary of State. And Burns, it's worth noting, actually left Yalta early. He had important business with the office of, or the, I think he was involved with the Office of War Production, or one of these agencies. Can't imagine why anything that was going on in any of these agencies would have been more important than what was happening at Yalta, but that's a different story. Burns comes home early and is less cued in to the decisions and compromises that are made on the ground. On the other hand, Admiral Leahy knew full well what was happening. There's a very famous exchange between Leahy and FDR at Yalta concerning the deal that's made over Poland. Now, what's decided for Poland is that there would be free and fair elections with the caveat that all anti-Nazi and democratic parties can participate. Well, that's pretty elastic language. And what everybody who was party to that agreement understood was that the ones who would get to decide what parties were sufficiently democratic and anti-Nazi were the Soviets, because after all, the Soviets were in control in Poland at the time. And I mentioned this exchange between Leahy and FDR. Leahy kind of pushes back against this language and said, Mr. President, you could stretch this language all the way to Washington without technically breaking it. FDR's answer was, I know, Bill, but this is the best I can do for the Polish people at this time. So Burns apparently is not aware of that. And Burns comes back and he says, well, look, we've got this great concession from the Soviets. They're going to allow free and fair elections. And when those free and fair elections, or at least elections that don't look free and fair from Truman's point of view, when they don't materialize, he immediately believes that the Soviets have broken the promises that they made at Yalta.
The interesting footnote to that, which is Burns, James Burns, who Truman appoints as Secretary of State, And Burns then goes on and spends about a year as Secretary of State. He goes to Russia on a diplomatic mission in 1946, a year after he's been Secretary of State. He comes back to the United States. He makes a mistake, John. He doesn't report to Truman. He goes in front of a press conference. Truman goes berserk and basically summons Burns along with William Leahy, who I would be quick to point out works for Truman for 4 years. Yeah. Leahy thinks it's going to be a transition, but among Truman, Burns, when Burns is in the doghouse, and Leahy, who is it that basically tells Burns that he's out as Secretary of State? It's William D. Leahy being Truman's enforcer, just like he frequently was Roosevelt's enforcer.
Leahy has been informed about the atomic bomb from a very early point. He's also been involved in the discussions of an invasion or the possible use of the bomb if it turns out it actually works. Okay, so here we have the last year of the war, from the summer of 1944 to the summer of 1945. What else do we need to care about regarding the end of World War II in the Pacific? What are the other critical issues and decisions that come into play when we're looking at the last months of the war there?
I think only maybe to put the spotlight back a little bit on Douglas MacArthur. I mean, the decision, of course, is made to drop the bomb. I think everyone, well, I don't want to overstate it too much, but I think there is a bit of surprise that Japan toes the line. And by the time September 2nd, 1945, the surrender aboard the Missouri occurs, I mean, one minute Japan is fighting tooth and nail, and the next minute, and MacArthur's relations and how he dealt with the emperor probably inform that a fair amount. But I guess my point would be that on the deck of the Missouri on September 2nd, 1945, MacArthur receives the Japanese surrender as the supreme Allied commander of all Allied forces. Nimitz is the representative of the United States and signs the surrender documents for the United States. But no matter what one wants to say about Douglas MacArthur, I think his presiding in a rather understated way, which he was usually very, very good at when he chose to take that route, really says something about bringing an end to World War II. And John, I would just suggest in closing, and maybe some other time we can talk more about the Cold War and your experiences there and what happens afterwards. But I would just suggest that September 2nd, 1945 is really the pinnacle, certainly, of American military power and perhaps political power as well.
The war, it seems to me, is too often portrayed as boom, Pearl Harbor, and then somewhere along the line, Iwo Jima comes, and then finally the big deus ex machina of the atomic bomb being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Of course, we know that all this stuff is more complicated, and that the end of World War II segues into the opening of the Cold War. It's clear, therefore, we can't understand today's global politics and strategic issues without understanding the role that World War II played in the origins of these things. I really want to thank Walt Borneman for joining us today and helping us to understand these very important connections. I'm really glad you were here with us, Walt.
Thanks for having me, John.
Also, make sure to check out Walt's book, The Admirals, at his Amazon page. That page is linked in the notes for this episode. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.